This is Jerry Smith, and we're doing an interview for the Fisher Body Historical Team. We're at Local 602 Union Hall in the conference room, and today we're interviewing Lyle Burcham, and the date is December 15th, 2005. It is 12:48, and we're going to go around the table and introduce everyone here, and then we'll start with Lyle's interview.
Marilyn Coulter.
John Fedewa.
Doug Rademacher.
Cheryl McQuaid.
Mike Fleming.
And Lyle, we'd like you to say your name and spell the last name.
Lyle Burchman, B-I-R-C-H-M-A-N.
And your address, please?
14777 Cutler Road, Portland, Michigan.
Okay, and what we'd like to know, are you married?
Yes.
Do you have children?
Three.
Okay, and what was your hiring date at Fisher Body?
August 23rd, 1976.
And what department did you hire in at?
Trim.
Have you always stayed in trim?
No.
What was your first job?
Installing center post trim on Delta 88s, 98s, and windshield post moldings on Tornados.
Okay. How long did you stay in trim?
A number of years. My wrist started going bad, so I transferred to QC. And that still was out in the trim department, working in the water test booth.
Okay. And how long did you stay on that job?
Probably up into the late 80s.
Cheryl McQuaid. Lyle, when you first walked into the plant, how did you feel about walking into the factory? What did you think?
Oh, I was wide-eyed. It was nothing I'd ever experienced before. Nowadays, folks go through like a week of orientation. We went through our interview process, and they told you you had the job. You came in, and there was a brief, you know. I remember laughing about this. The fellow that did the orientation referred to it as a career, and I never intended to work here any longer than till the next layoff, and I was going to go on and do something else, and here I am almost 30 years later. But I remember that point. I kind of chuckled. I thought, I'm not going to stay here very long. It was funny. I even wrote this one down. They herded us like cattle almost. They took us out, and the bosses would point to, oh, I'll take that one, and that one. They didn't even ask you your name or anything. And then after they took you away, they asked you your name, and they assigned me to a job, and I learned it. And I remember it was, being August, it was so hot. And, you know, I'm just a kid right out of high school, and it was so hot, and I had no idea what was going on in that plant. And I even asked the boss, I said, do they have to heat this place in the summer? Or, I mean, in the wintertime? Because, of course, we all know that you had to. But, yeah, I remember that.
Why did you hire, whatever made you put your application in at Fisher Body?
I wanted to make money. They were paying $7 an hour. Yeah.
Lyle, Marilyn Coulter, just so that they know, how tall are you?
6'5".
And how did that affect you when you came in here insofar as working on the line?
Well, I was thankful that I had that center post trim job and that I could stand up. And from my height, the leverage was very, I was well suited for that job. I like to think maybe the boss actually put me there out of the goodness of his heart. I have no idea. But that worked out real well. Getting in the Tornados was kind of tough. Because you had to lean in there and you had to take a drill and drill the hole out. They didn't have anything like self-tapping screws in those days. So you had to lean in there right underneath it. And because I am tall, I was right up to that windshield post and drill the hole and then drive a screw and then get back out of the car. And I remember this older fella, heck, he was old. He coached me that day. I'd get in the car and sit down and try and pry that out. And he said, son, you always want to try to stand up while you do this. It'll be quicker and easier for you. And he was right in the end. Yes, sir.
Mike Fleming, who was your first foreman that you worked for, and how was he to work for?
Well, I worked for Jim Marshall and Tex Ross. You know, they would rotate back and forth, and they were both really good guys. They were the best. Never bothered you. I will make a comment, though. In those days, the term ergonomics was relatively unknown. And one of the things they wanted us to do was fit these plastic trim pieces. I did fail to mention that on the two doors, I had to install the quarter panel trim. And that kind of led to my wrist screwing up over the years. You literally had to pound that in and catch it on some clips that were hidden. And being that the customer sees this stuff, you had to make it look as nice as possible. So that was an issue, and I complained about it after, well, this is quite some time later, maybe a year or two later. My wrist started to really suffer from that, and I was given this ridiculous plastic headed hammer that all it was going to do is damage the part. You know, Jim looked at me, and I looked at him, and he was such a nice guy. I just took it and kept going back to doing the job. But to this day, you know, that wrist clicks, and y'all hear that?
Well, yeah. You said that you were only going to work here until your next layoff.
Yep.
Were you ever in any layoffs?
Only when the entire plant shut down.
Was that for any amount of time?
Well, you know, you had different shutdowns for renovations, you know, when they added new equipment. I think back in 99 we had some downtime. But as far as layoff according to seniority due to tough times, it never happened to me. Never. In all these years, I guess the reason why is back in 73, all the folks that hired in then were laid off, and they were off for so long. So you'll see on the seniority list, there's a big jump. You either have 70 or 71 seniority, and then it jumps to 76. So there had been quite a stretch of time before anybody was hired into the plant. And this group of people with 76 seniority, we basically enjoyed a tremendous amount of opportunity as far as putting in for jobs and not going through the layoffs. However, some of those folks did get laid off. I know in 78 they went to one shift, I believe, and I still hung in there on that. Stayed on days, almost 90 days, and then I went to nights.
Yeah. So, Maryland Culture, Lyle, when you came in, you're 6'5", you come into the plant. Were there any kind of new hire initiations or pranks that were played on you when you first came in?
Not that I want to really go into here. At the 90th day, but I'm not going to go into that.
You don't want to share that
one? Nah, we'll leave that one out. Yeah.
Mike Fleming, Lyle. How about strikes? Have you ever been and any strikes that they've had through?
Well, there was that one where it was pretty exciting. They handed out the signs, and I forget the date. It was just a few years back. We all went out and with our picket signs right out the front door there, and that was kind of cool. It didn't last very long. That's good.
Do you know? Do you remember what it might have been for?
No. I really don't. It was about work rule or safety. But it had something to do with something else. And dang, I'm a little embarrassed.
Do you have any family members that work here, Lyle?
No. I did have a family member that worked here. I met my wife here.
Really?
Yeah. She hired in, and we were married back in 1980, and she worked for a while, and then our kids started coming along, and I asked her, I said, look, you were working here before you ever met me, and if you want to keep working, we'll work it out. And, you know, many people do that very successfully. However, you know, we did have a couple of years where we didn't have any kids, and we were able to save some money and get ahead. And I told her, I said, you know, it's your call. If you want to stay home with the kids, I'm cool with that. So she did. But this is where we met. We met up in 3X, up in the trim department.
Well, I mean,
mm-hmm.
So
little Fisher Body romance.
Did she retire, Lyle? Did she just leave of absence, quit? What did she do?
Oh, gee, she just quit.
Just quit?
Yeah. Okay. Right after our daughter Monica Lynn was born.
How long had she worked here prior to quitting?
She hired in 78, and she quit in late 82.
Sure, about 4 years.
Yeah. Yes, Cheryl.
Cheryl McCoy. Lyle, you said you met your wife at Fisher Body.
Mm-hmm.
Did you experience any problems with dating her, with just being in the plant all day together?
Well, fortunately, soon after we were married, her wiring job that she did got moved clear to the other end of the plant, so we weren't on top of each other all day long, you know. We'd drive in together, and she had her time, and I had mine, and so that was probably pretty good. But we're still married, so it's working out. It's been 25 years now.
Great.
When you went to the second shift, you stayed on the center pillar job?
Yeah.
Okay.
Probably shouldn't have stayed on that one job that many years, but it was a really good job, and I was tall. And I know everybody here is pretty familiar with trim operations, and you know the alternatives that were available to a tall guy. So, you know, Marilyn, you brought up a very good point. Ergonomically speaking, there's no way I could have done that headliner job. Remember that old headliner job where you had to climb in? Impossible. So I kind of stayed where I could relatively do the job without getting hurt.
So, Lyle, Marilyn Holder, were you from Portland when you came to work here in Lansing?
I lived not too far from there. I lived in Wacoosta.
Wacoosta. Coming from Wacoosta and coming into Lansing, what was that like for you? Were there any kind of big surprises, anything that was different that you were unaccustomed to when you came here?
Probably the only thing that I found really weird is these guys goosing each other. To this day, I just think it's ridiculous behavior. It's something I don't agree with, and that was probably the only thing that bothered me. As far as Lansing, I had the good pleasure of selling Kirby vacuum cleaners while in high school, so I drove all around Lansing anyhow and met people of every walk of life. In fact, I was able to sell a few Kirby vacuum cleaners that first year to some coworkers at an excellent price, I might add. I gave them some great deals. And
for those people who were like yourself, had never been around that, can you please explain to the people what goosing is?
Oh, well, you know, guys grabbing each other's behinds or fronts. It was pretty... To this day, I don't go along with that, and I don't think that's one of the reasons why, you know, Lansing's got a great culture as far as building quality cars, and something we're all very proud of, and that has no bearing on it at all. It's just a limited few, and I happened to be working with them at the time.
So those are just some of the pranks that some people did do.
Oh, yeah. I had a guy come up to me with a broom, old Harvey there, and, man, he hurt me, you know. He was terrified, you know. No, it wasn't like you think, Doug. But he just came up and poked me, and dang, I went right to the floor. And if I could have got up, I probably would have lit into him, you know. It hurt.
Cheryl McQuay, how old were you, Lyle, when you hired in?
I was 18 years old. Been out of high school just a couple months.
And what was, when the early years, what were some of your typical lunch? What did you do for lunch?
Eat.
Did you have lunch?
I know that first couple years, you know, I just ate lunch. But there was one summer where I was living with a bunch of buddies, and I had a big garden, and I'd bring all this homegrown food in. And my dear friend Marilyn Coulter, one day, she said, "Lyle, what you got there?" And I said, "Well, I have some carrots." And I had just yanked them out of the ground, threw them in a bag. I didn't even bother cleaning them up. And she was kind of horrified that I had this dirty carrots that I wasn't even going to, you know, wash. I said, "Oh, you just wipe the dirt off and eat them." But lunch break, you know, I had a lot of different things going on.
Mike Fleming. Well, so... Where did you go after you, you left trim, you went to the, what department?
Water test.
QC.
In
quality
in
control.
In trim?
It was, yeah, the water test booth was located in the trim department.
Well, did you spend the rest of your time in trim? Where did you end up eventually? Where did you move someplace?
The body shop.
The body shop. Talk about the body shop. How do you like that? What's going on down there?
I thought the body shop was by far the most interesting experience as far as working in the manufacturing side of it all. I still, to this day, am just flat out amazed at the technology that we employ.
So what did you do in the body shop in quality control?
Weld integrity.
What's that?
Can I share a little bit about that with you?
Sure.
Okay. A lot of folks in trim were rather intimidated by the body shop. And what happened is in a cutback, my water test position was gradually eliminated, and I ended up being forced back to the production line. And I worked for a while working in the glass area, setting glass. I'll get to body in just a second, okay? And I worked there for a while and ended up setting windshields, back windows, and being a relief person out there. And one day they came around and, I'm gonna go way out here, but I'll bring it on back, okay? They were talking about these non-traditional jobs that were going to open up. And one of them was a plant tour guide. And I didn't think I'd get it because I'd interviewed for other jobs as well. And they asked me, why do you think we should give plant tours? And I'm convinced that probably the reason why they asked me to do it, I just, without missing a beat, to sell cars. So I did tours for a while, but that was an on-again, off-again thing. And I'd always have to go back to production. Sometimes I was installing door panels, or sometimes I was setting glass or whatever. And one day they came up to me and said, there's been an opening. You have return rights back to quality control. Unfortunately, it's out in the body shop. Well, I had driven that tour train all over the plant. And I'll never forget this one fella out in the body shop. He'd always wave at us, but some days he wouldn't wave. And I, you know, couldn't figure it out until I realized he had mastered the art of sitting there looking like he was doing something. He was sleeping. He had sunglasses on. And I realized what job he was on. Well, they told me what job it was, and I said, yeah, I'm more than willing. It was weld integrity. Not that everybody sat and slept on weld integrity. It's a very high-stress job. However, a funny story, a number of my water test coworkers had been given that same offer. They ultimately, to go back a step or two, they eliminated the water test department completely, so we all were dispersed. They transferred that over to the chassis plant. So these guys from trim, they washed out really quickly. So when I showed up, he was an old school boss, and Dan Wood, he did not want to see my face. All he knew that I was from trim and that I would probably wash out just like all the other guys, and they got all intimidated from the noise, the smoke, and everything in the body shop. Well, I knew better. I did tours out through there, and I knew there was some great opportunities, and weld integrity was one of them. And I looked him right in the eye, and I told him, I said, Dan, I will do you the best job possible, and you're going to be happy with me. And I think if you asked him today, he probably would say, yeah. And I did that job off and on for 10, 12 years.
So Dan Wood had a brother, I think. Did you know his brother?
Yeah, I did. I never really got to know him that well other than, hey, how you doing?
Here's the question. Most folk didn't seem to get along with Dan or his brother, Burr. You got along with him pretty well then, huh?
Well, let me ask you, how'd you get along with him, all right?
Excellently. I welded. Here. Dan would ask for me to come weld for him, as a matter of fact. When you, as a weld integrity individual, you would be a dog catcher, whatever you'd be. If you had welds missing,
yep,
I'd be the guy come get them. So, yeah, we got along well.
And I did that dog catcher job off and on for years and years. And, yeah, it's important to have someone like you that can step right up and make it happen. Back to Dan. Yeah, you know, he had a way of ruffling people's feathers, and there was a time or two that he kind of disappointed me, but all in all, we got along just fine.
One more thing while you're on it. There was a specific well that was missed that was called for darn near discharge. You had government wells or something like that, that if you missed those, can you talk about that? What happened there with those situations?
Well, MVSS wells, that was really, really a critical thing. You had to make sure that those welds were in the right location and that they were holding. And over the years, I don't know if you want me to elaborate on
that.
Can
you tell us what MVSS wells are, please?
Hand integrity weld and the dog thing, what you said.
But what does MVSS mean first?
Oh, yeah. A motor vehicle safety standard. And the weld integrity, it's a process of monitoring weld quality. There's two things that we would do. We would take a hammer and chisel and place the chisel between the welds and drive, hit it with a hammer and drive that in between so it forced the metal. And that's kind of a crude way of doing it, but it's still a very effective way of monitoring weld quality. The other thing we would do is take a perfectly good car off the car track line, which is an assembly line where they weld the sides of the car to the roof of the car and the floor pan together. And they take that car and measure every weld and cut all the welds apart and peel them back. Remember the old style tuna fish cans? The guys, they called them can openers. Basically, it was like a T-wrench. You'd lock onto the metal and spin that metal off and peel that metal away. And in that manner, we would monitor the weld quality. The dog catcher that Mike was referring to, what the dog catcher position was is if you're under out working in the underbody or on the car track line or in a side frame line and you had a weld come up bad, it was a dog catcher's responsibility to, as those cars made it to the final body shop line, they would continually check until those bad welds came, and then we would have a repair person repair those welds right on the line. So that's what the dog catcher would do. Yes?
Lyle, Marilyn Coulter. Actually, I'm going to come out of the body shop and go back to trim from where you first came in.
Sure.
And you did the jobs, and I wanted to know, what was the environment in trim like? What types of things? Now, you were on days for 90 days, correct?
Mm-hmm.
And you were on nights for how long? How long were you in trim
15
after?
15 years.
And you did 15 years. In that 15 years, can you tell me what working in the trim shop was like? What types of things did you do for lunch? What types of things did you guys do? Things special for holidays? Were there any special types of things that you did to pass the time?
I know for a while there, we would play chess, and you know you'd work for and make a move and. It took all day to do it, but at least keep your mind functioning. Playing a little harmonica, do that too, in between breaks, and go down in the stairwell where it would echo so well. To this day, I still love parking ramps, stairwells where you get a great echo. I still play today. And funny story, this one boss I had, I was coming out on break, and she saw me coming up out of the stairway, and she assumed I'd been in there smoking and drinking. She wanted to burn me for it, but I tried to explain to her that, well, this echoes so well. I was practicing my harmonica in there. One of the things that I remember about trim is that I did like the fact that you could, up in 3X there, you could look out the window. And I used to joke that I had an office with a view. The lower row of windows were clear, and then the upper ones were opaque. Over the years, one had been broken, and they had replaced it with a clear pane of glass. Standing at my bench, I could stand right there and see the Capitol Dome illuminated in the night sky. So that's why I joked I had an office with a view. There was a couple things that I thought was just awful. The loud wheels on the carts. And what I guess was the most frustrating part was the guys on material at that time had time to go slow, and they had a total disregard for the health and well-being of their fellow workers. They roar by there, and it was deafening. And that continued for years. I had earmuffs that I'd try and put them on when they came by. But that I always thought that was rather insulting. That I guess in life you're going to run into people who have a selfish attitude, and it's kind of unfortunate for the rest of us. I remember another guy, not to beat up our friends on material because I have a tremendous amount of respect for him, but I remember an episode, it's always stuck in my head, this old guy named Sarge. And he had to deliver these upper rails. You know, as the years went by, my job changed, and we used to refer to it as a rail. It was a trim piece that went along the headliner and the door opening, and it would attach to the windshield post-molding trim piece. And he would sit there on his fork truck, and he insisted that he could only deliver these to one station. So I would have to, in between doing the job on the line, because I was young, I would have to go get that other box from another location and bring it down. And I always thought that was just the most appalling thing. And the boss never did anything about it. It was just kind of one of those things where never forgotten. But it was always nice and, for the most part, quiet. You know, work out in the body shop, you plan on wearing earplugs the whole time.
So while you were working in trim for those 15 years, did you develop any other lessons, friendships outside of your wife that extended outside the workplace?
Yeah, lots of people everywhere. I mean, to this day, you know, that's one of the nice things. I think that's one of the reasons why General Motors has built two plants in Lansing is just excellent people. Please don't get me wrong on those two instances of selfishness, because for the most part, everybody's the most giving, friendly people you could ever meet. And I've always appreciated that fact that, you know, Lansing, for the most part, is a small town. You can't go to the lumber yard or a grocery store or a mall where, you know, half the time you're going to run into somebody you know. And that's kind of nice about Lansing. It's big enough where there's a lot of neat stuff, but small enough where you still, it's like a small town. Comparing to metro areas, it is a small town. Want me to go into a little bit of water test on that trim stuff?
If you'd like, please.
We used to water test the cars. They'd go through a 4-minute spray booth, and they would put chemicals in the water so it would react to a black light. So you had this two-bay station. A bay is the length of a car. So you had two lengths of a car that was a booth that was all painted black, and you'd use these black lights, and you'd shine it in there, and the water would actually glow, so you could determine where you had a water leak. Our job was to monitor the water leaks in the car. And if there was no leaks in the car, well, that was good. You did every fourth car. And so you were able to do your job, and if you did have leaks, then that's why you did every fourth car. A year or so later, they moved it to every third car, and then every other car, as the quality or the leak issues went away. But one of the things that always concerned me was the fact that these chemicals, this water's dripping on you. You lean in the car, and it drips on you, and you just had to wonder, you know, what are the long-term health effects? And then on Monday mornings, the booth would stink to high heaven because you had some bacteria that was thriving in that water. So on top of the dye that they would put in the water, they had all these bactericides that they would add to it. It was a real witch's brew of some really bad stuff. And it always ate at me that I'm thinking, you know, I hope I don't die from this. Probably one of the more appalling things about water test was the fact that after you made a repair, some of the sealer was clear, some of it was a black gooey stuff, some of it was urethane. And if you got this on the car, you were expected to clean it up. So they had these cans of oleum and cotton, and you just reach over and plunge that cotton in there and clean it up. Well, years later, thanks to the UAW prompting the government to encourage safe use of some of these chemicals, they told me that I might as well have been drinking that oleum because it absorbs right through your skin and it harms your liver. So hopefully the old liver will last the rest of my life, but I think of the years where it was a known issue and it was not addressed. And even to this day, I still see people on the outside in various walks of life that think nothing of cleaning up their hands in gasoline. And for that, I'm grateful that I was at least instructed at that early point. Because there's folks that have been doing it all their lives, and then when they develop cancer in their 60s, they wonder how they got it. Well, yes, sir.
Mike Fleming. So that you're talking about led to what we have is the MSDS, the Michigan Safety Data Sheets, which, mm-hmm. Could you talk about that? Do you know anything about it?
Well, other than what you just said there, and I thought it was a great thing. And, you know, one of the things that I'm very grateful is the efforts of the UAW to bring that sort of safety to it, ergonomics. You know, you walk through the trim department, you have ramps, you have areas where the product is elevated. This is all in an effort to encourage better production. It's a twofold thing. You get better quality and people don't get hurt. It's rather troubling that we have Republican lawmakers today that are trying to roll back some of this. And it's very appalling that George Bush, one of the first things he did upon taking office was to weaken ergonomic standards on a nationwide basis. This coming from a man who, during a photo op for the post-Katrina disaster, he was seen, I saw him on TV, attempting to drive a nail in a Habitat for Humanity house. And the guy held the hammer like a big sissy. He was choked up on it. He was hitting it like a little kid. It probably took him 12 hits to drive a number eight nail into a piece of OSB. And so the height of hypocrisy coming from the leadership of our country as regards to working people. This is a man that never worked a day in his life. Can't even drive a nail, for crying out loud, yet. So enough of that, but talking about ergonomics, I'm very thankful for the progressive approach that ergonomics has been dealt with in the plan.
Lyle, question to you, Marilyn Coulter. We had the ergonomics you talked about and the safety standards, and then you also said that you had a non-traditional job of being a guide. During your time here, we had a number of different training-type programs and different programs that allowed the employees to get involved. Can you say how and when you got involved in those types of programs?
Well, they used to call them employee participation groups, and I was working at Water Test in the time, and none of the old guys wanted to have anything to do with this thing. They just trotting out a new program, and I thought, well, I'll do it. So I was the EPG leader. And I actually was sent away for a week for a training seminar, and it was great. They taught you communication skills, and, you know, I came away with a better understanding. Of course, it has to be a two-way thing, and over the years, I think every one of us has grappled with the one-way type of communication. They trot out a program and say it's going to work, and then they never held up that end of it. I think over the years, that's gotten better. I know it has.
Do you feel that these programs have helped to make Lansing the capital of quality?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, one of the programs I had a tremendous amount of respect for is the suggestion plan. You know, I'm a firm believer in incentives. And out in Weld Integrity, once I found out that they'll actually pay you to come up with ideas, well, I was looking at everything, and I came up with all sorts of ideas, that everything from safety to weld positions, that, you know, welds that we didn't really need and welds that should be moved and or eliminated, and it was fascinating.
Mike Fleming, due to some of the ideas you came up with, did your suggestions fly? Did you get compensated?
I remember, there's a number of safety ideas that I came up with. Out in the body shop, it's really a different world. And I guess that's why those guys washed up when they came out to Weld Integrity. It's dangerous if you don't know what you're doing. You know, you have robots They're protected by three different modes of protection, though. You have pressure-sensitive mats. You have light screen technology, where if you break that light screen, a beam of light is reflected around a given area. It automatically shuts the system down, and the most obvious would be fencing. But it, nonetheless, there's still a lot of opportunities to get hurt, one of which is I have about a 2-inch scar on my wrist, and then there's about an 1.5-inch scar right next to it. Almost looks like an anchor, doesn't it? I was on my tour guide job at the time, and one of my friends from high school yelled over to me to come back after I got done with my tour, so I went out there. And there was water on the floor. You know, it was, they were doing what's called wet deck sanding. They were doing some light sanding. And the problem was, is there was oil mixed with that water. It's a very slippery surface. And there was really no notice given, no yellow paint on the floor warning you. There was no fencing, no anything. Here I am, unfamiliar with the area. I slipped and I went to catch myself, and I caught my wrist on that metal flange that you install the rubber gasket around your trunk on every vehicle. But out in the body shop, that wasn't there, so it ripped me wide open on my wrist. And I thought I was going to die that night. You know what, though? It was my lucky day. I'll tell you why. I just missed that main artery. By the grace of God, I just missed that main artery. And so the bleeding wasn't as severe as it really should have or could have been. So I'm very grateful for that. But, you know, there was issues of safety out there. One safety issue, I was able to convince management to put up a fence. There was a stairway that would come down from the bathrooms, and we had an electrified rail that was part of a new conveyor system that was installed back in 99 out there in C underbody. And you could literally reach out and touch this rail. And We put a fence up over that, and it's there to this day. So, you know, electrocution was avoided. There was other times when we were able to eliminate welds that were not needed, or move welds that into a better location. In the world of weld integrity, you have to realize there's a whole school of engineering that goes into that. You have different layers of metal. You have galvanized metal versus bare metal. These all need to be taken into consideration when designing a weld schedule to weld these different layers of metal together. So there was a lot of opportunity to improve upon the process. Many of my coworkers on weld integrity came up with good ideas. Even though we weren't engineers, there was a lot of us that knew exactly what was going on and how to better the product.
So, Lyle, what was the most you'd ever gotten awarded through suggestions?
$2,700.
Very good. Have you ever worked any changeovers, Lyle?
The 99 changeover, I worked some of that, being that they were, if you think about it, they were installing new robots. And mind you, it isn't the robot that does the welding. The robot just moves a weld gun. And so they needed some people to work and help qualify these guns to make sure they were up to snuff, to make sure everything was going to be, the welds would be in the right location when production came up to being.
So was that a long time that you worked that changeover, hours-wise? What did you talk about?
Well, it was 40 hours a week. We didn't work any long hours then, but I did work a lot of weekends. I had the pleasure of working with UAW Local 602 electricians many, many weekends. Funny story. You want to hear a funny body shop story?
Sure.
We all have our gifts. And I won't name names because I really liked both those guys. They were wonderful people, but I was working on days, and Dan Wood, he always felt like, I mean, he was an old school manager. It felt like it was his money, so he wouldn't just let people come in and work weekends unless he was absolutely sure. Well, we were programming station 34 out on the car track line. That's the one where you weld the sides and the floor pan together, and the electricians were programming for the trunk area. The 34 does that. And the one guy worked and worked and worked on that for like 8 hours. And there was nobody coming in on the night shift because Dan never brought anybody in. So we ended up staying. But just a funny story, he had worked and worked and tried to get that gun. Fortunately, on the night shift, one of the electricians came in who was very good at programming. And I kid you not, 20 minutes later, he had that thing moving like a ballerina.
Lyle, did you notice when you were in a body shop and shift changed, quality changed, or per se, one shift might have ran smoother than the other?
Sometimes. Some areas ran better. Talking about quality, in the old days, when I first came on Weld Integrity, if you had a malfunction, there's a anywhere from 12 to 18 inch long cable that's like an inch and a half thick. We used to call it a jumper. It's on a weld gun. And as that gun makes these welds, this thing's moving the whole time as the gun opens and closes. You can see how this cable would move each time. Over time, that's going to wear out. Well, in the old days, as that would deteriorate, it would have an effect on weld quality. And if you had a weld breaking, sometimes it was that, sometimes it was a whole host of other things. But if you had occasionally a jumper will just burn up, and then you're very concerned because you had no idea how many welds were bad up until your last check. And with the emergence of new technology in computerization, they've been able to take that whole issue out of the equation. Last summer, I was working out in underbody, or a year ago last summer, and we had a jumper burn up. And my first thought is, okay, I better check the bank of cars that we have, because every area has a bank of cars. So if you have an issue, you have a bank so your production continues. And I'll have you know that was the only job that was bad. That one, and it was only that one spot. They've actually improved the technology to a point where that computer in that weld controller will actually consider what's going on and up the voltage and compensate for any wear and tear that jumper might be suffering. I mean, this kind of technology is improved weld quality dramatically. Tip dresser technology as well, where the accumulating weld slag would gather on the weld caps, and they would. This was something that they installed back in '99 and perfected over the years. After the robot gets done welding, it goes to the home position. However, after 200 to 300 welds, depending on the severity of the welding, it would go in and grind the debris off the cap. I don't know if I wanted to. You want me to go there or not?
One more question while we're talking about the technical stuff. It's you're in a body shop.
Uh-huh.
You know, you worked down there for like 10 years or more?
Yeah.
You're familiar with the C-line and the M-line. Mm-hmm. And when they changed the M-line over and the C-line, we're talking specifically underbodies now. And how did it affect your job when the M-line would not run so well and it started taking all these cars from the C-line and pulling them over so these guys would work more? Are you familiar with that concept at all?
That didn't bother me too much because I was doing quality control. But, yeah, that had potential issues. From our perspective is we had to be able to discern whether it was a C-line or an M-line underbody.
And once it had crossed over, you
mean? Oh, yeah. And, oh, my gosh, from a dog catcher perspective, where if you're running repair, you had to know where the right stampings were on each one to know whether it was a C or an M body. And, yeah, it just changed the equation somewhat. Talking about technology, can I share this one little thing? When I hired in, there was none of the technology there. It was like old times. The body shop had all handguns. They didn't bring in the car track process and a lot of the heavily automated stuff till the changeover in 84. But I'll never forget this. And at the time, I just went, huh. But it's always stuck in my mind. The summer of 77, We went down for a changeover, and I used to walk out through the body shop every day to the parking lot. And there were these two guys that were working on a floor pan. They'd load a part in and hand weld it. Well, they weren't there after I came back through, and they had a Hart automatic doing the welding. A Hart automatic is a weld gun that moves into a position, and it'll only weld one or two spots, and then it pulls back. But that was like the... That was... I saw that, and I went, hmm. And, you know, at one point, the Lansing Car Assembly Body Plant, formerly known as Fisher Body, probably had the greatest concentration of robots anywhere in the world, because we were essentially two assembly plants under one roof, upwards of 650 robots. In fact, I would share that fact with folks when we did the tours.
Going away from that, you just said Lansing Car Assembly, formerly Fisher Body. We've went through a lot of name changes at Fisher Body. How did you feel about that?
I thought BOC was stupid. You know, we didn't even build Cadillacs. You know, it's one of those really ridiculous things from the mindset typical of Richard Wagner today. You know, we had different CEOs that cook up these things. Kind of like George Bush doesn't know how to hammer. I think we had some CEOs that didn't have a clue on how to manage things, and they come up with something ridiculous like BOC. You guys want to hear a story?
Sure.
This is a classic. You know, we've won all these awards, and this is just a few years ago. Working for John Rosendahl, they would have him do anything and everything, and being that we worked for him with the tours, we were the guys that did a lot of this stuff. We had won a quality award, the J.D. Power Quality Award, and we all received coats. Well, we were to set the coat distribution up in the skill center, which was on the second floor. We had to use the freight elevator behind the cafeteria. So what we would do is bring up all these boxes through this freight elevator, load them on a little gurney, and then push it through what was called, well, formerly the executive dining room, which was at the time, you know, 3 years ago, 4 years ago, it was the, we called it the special function room. And we had pushed some tables and chairs out of the way, and we were moving through that area out over to the skill center to set up our distribution room for the coats. Well, there's this middle-aged gal in there, and we're moving coats through, and I said hi to her, and she was still there when we came back through, and she was moving chairs and stacking them against the wall. And we kept moving, and finally I asked her, I said, is there something I can do for you? You know, I'm just kind of, what's going on here type of thing, because it was kind of strange. Turns out, she was concerned because there was a new GM program they were rolling out. Evidently, the new protocol coming from guys like Rick Wagner and their ilk, they had determined that you could not stack chairs more than three deep. And because we had moved some tables and chairs, she was concerned that these were not stacked more than three deep. Now, coming from the body shop where you have light screen technology, you have fences, you have pressure-sensitive matting, and the potential to get injuries like the wrist injury, I just thought that was the most hilarious and ridiculous thing I'd ever heard of. Here they're paying this woman lots of money to worry if the chairs are more than three deep stacked. You know, while I'm on that subject, can I share one more thing with you? We used to have segregation when I first hired in. And what I mean by segregation is we had segregated parking. If you were hourly, you had to park further out. If you were salary, you had a special parking lot up close. And if an hourly person parked in that salary parking area, they would tow your vehicle. You were subject to disciplinary action as well. We also had segregated eating areas. We had the executive dining room, the salary cafeteria, and then the hourly cafeteria, each with a declining level of quality of food. And at the time, I didn't think anything of it. You know, it's all a matter of perspective, and if you don't know any better, looking back, I think it's kind of ironic in a good sort of way that the former salary cafeteria was turned into our skill center, which was open to both salary and hourly people to use the computers and the library. And the executive dining room was used for special functions. got off on that when I told the story about bringing the coats through there. But yeah, we used to have segregation in the old days. Now everybody gets... I used to joke with people on the tours. I'd tell them, now everybody's subject to the same lovely food. But you know what? Our office for the tours was in the back of the cafeteria, and I can't say enough about the wonderful folks that worked in the cafeteria up there. They're all great folks, and really the food wasn't that bad. I thought their biscuits and gravy were some of the best.
Well, Mike Fleming, what would you consider would be one of your best memories of Fisher Body Paint?
Oh, lots of good memories. I mean, meeting my wife, and obviously that's the most significant thing that could have come out of this whole. But I'll tell you what, some of them that are happy, really happy memories was some of the times just sitting and talking with people and sharing good times, jokes, and deep conversations. I had a dear friend, Ed Wargle. I used to play harmonica with him. He's passed on. He retired a number of years ago, but he used to play that thing constantly. And I often wondered if he didn't drive his partner crazy. They were skilled trades, and they were tinners, tinsmiths, and they would drive around on the... Lloyd would drive, and Ed would play that harmonica, and I thought to myself, you know, I play these things, but even that would drive me bananas listening to it all day long. And... you know, we had some great times, great conversations. I'll never forget probably another real significant thing that happened in my life was the old UAW GM talent shows. And 19 years ago, I didn't have anything to do with it. A guy named Don Loomis came up to me, approached me, and he approached everybody, and we put a band together for this. At the time, it was a talent contest. And we didn't win. I think we took second or third. Joanne Moore, she always would win because she's such an amazing singer. I just love to hear her sing. And that night, though, we had such a good time, and we had a great time practicing. We've been together ever since. In fact, after we realized that, hey, this is kind of fun, we put together a bluegrass gospel band, and we played just one song, and we had a great time. And we got together and continued playing. We've been playing ever since. But the first time we ever played as a group outside of that talent show was right here in the UAW Local 602 Hall. And, you know, coming from a rather conservative church background, and these guys were all pretty much... they came from a background where you testify and you praise the Lord, raise your hand, and let her all hang out. Picture this, you know, I'm playing with these guys. I don't know them that well. And we're right here at the UAW Local 602 Hall. And Doug Prater, he's a Pentecostal boy. He had broke a string. So it's time to do some talking. If you have a string break, why, it's time to talk, you know. So you can't just stand there, everybody's wide-eyed. And he says, "Lyle, how about a testimony of what the Lord's done for you?" And, you know, I'd never said anything in public like that in my whole life, man. So I mumbled this and that and got through it, but I'll never forget that one. And I know it doesn't have anything to do with building cars, but it does, because our group, you know, we literally got our start here. And Don Loomis and I and Bruce Pettinger, Larry Leopard, bless his heart, he passed on 11 years ago. He had cancer, and great guy. Even to this day, I hear "I'll Fly Away," I think, of Larry. Good guy.
Lyle, it's Doug Rademacher. I worked with you also over the years, and you blew harmonica, and it was a pleasure for people. But I remember very vividly that there was a gentleman that played guitar, and he looked like John Denver, and he'd bring his guitar in, and you would hook up. Can you tell some stories about what you do for people on your breaks or lunches? Were you ever requested to do things for retirement parties or anything like that inside the facility?
Well, that was Greg Smith. I always call him Guitar Greg, and this guy can play anything from the 40s, 50s, 60s. He even learns these songs that kids are listening to today, you know. I used to joke about it a few years ago. I never in my wildest dreams thought I'd be playing a Green Day song, for instance. But I did, playing with Greg. And we would have some great times. I first met him when I was working underbody. And this is probably about, 10, 12 years ago. And I saw this guy carrying a guitar. And, I was fascinating. And, you know, we got together on lunch break. But one of the problems you had out in the body shop, it was so noisy even when you're not building cars. All the ventilation systems, all the equipment that's conveyors. And we used to have to, you know, play over that noise. But a lot of times we'd get in break areas. I remember we had these team rooms. One was painted blue, and we used to joke that we were playing at the Blue Room Lounge. Remember that one, Doug? And we had some good times.
Lyle, you mentioned Greg a little bit. Again, was there a time when anyone asked you to play inside the plant for a dinner or anything? Somebody retiring?
Off and on, yeah, we do that. I remember one year the guy I played guitar with. He's not in UAW Local 602. He's a good union man, fixes elevators here in Lansing. But he came in the plant, and Bruce and I. And we played I don't even remember the guy's last name, Burr. He was an electrician. He retired, and we played a short set of bluegrass gospel music just for him. That was pretty cool. Okay. Another thing along those same lines of playing music, one of those memories that's forever seared in my mind, there used to be a fellow by the name of Billy Harper, worked material, over by the train dock out in Trim, the train dock right there. He had a little office, and not really sure what he did, but we were all on break at the time. And Bruce Pettinger came out with his banjo. Don had his mandolin. I had the harmonica, and Billy had the fiddle. And we had one other guy join us playing, beating out a rhythm on the flat top. And that little room was just packed, and we were playing bluegrass music, and we still laugh about it today.
Lyle, you can you talk about your union a little bit? The years, have you had to use the union? Did you have a time where you appreciated the UAW? And do you take time to vote?
Yes, yes, and yes.
You want to elaborate for me a little bit on something? What you hired in, did the union support you when you first hired in? Did you ever need them early on?
You know, I wasn't involved at all when I first hired in. Actually, I ruffled a few feathers back in 79. I've always been kind of political, and I always knew which side of the bread the butter was on. I always was appreciative of my union benefits, but, you know, I didn't regularly get involved in a lot of stuff early on. I was just a kid, 18 years old, living my life. But I also had a sense of political right and wrong. And I was involved in the anti-nuclear movement of the 70s. And there was 5,000 of us marched on Midland back in 79 or 78, right in there. And, the Midland nuclear power plant never did come into being, due to grassroots concern. And I'll never forget it. The Board of Water and Light at the time was going to buy into the Midland nuclear plant. And I don't even remember the fella's name, but there was a guy who was a UAW appointee on the Board of Water and Light or on some committee. It's been so long ago, and it just hit me. Should have researched this before I showed up. But I remember getting up at the union meeting and chastising, saying, why is this? Because he hadn't been instructed to vote one way or the other. But that's about the only time that I really had a run. And at that point, that vote was corrected. And that led to the Board of Water and Light not buying into the Midland Nuclear Power Plant, which was a financial boondoggle. Here's the Board of Water and Light, by virtue of their independence, has been able to provide the Lansing area with affordable electricity. And there were people that did not have the goodwill of the people in mind when they tried to do that merger. And that poor guy, he didn't know what was going on. He was just there because they appointed him, you know. But I felt pretty good about that one. We were able to keep them. Unfortunately, they did get the Board of Water and Light did lose some of their independence. They hooked up with Edison on a coal-fired plant, and to this day, I still think the Board of Water and Light should have done everything they could to maintain their independence to better serve Lansing. And that has a bearing on General Motors as well, because by providing a good, affordable, steady source of electricity and steam, that was a big plus for the Grand River Assembly Plant being located right there by the power station, and they were able to make the best use of that. And the new Delta plant, if you think about it, it's right there by the other Board of Water and Light power station.
Lyle, given your
Maryland Coulter,
given your activity that you just spoke about, and are you active in your union currently? And if so, do you hold a position? And if so, what position is that?
Well, a little background. Each political election, I have to go way back, okay? Back when Ronald Reagan won the first time, I was heartbroken. I'll never forget this. The returns came in, and I went over to Harry's Bar to drink a double. I was so depressed, and I'm sitting there right next to some guy, a fellow auto worker, who was happy, obviously an idiot. And we all know the damage that Ronald Reagan's regime brought to working people. Fast forward to the last election, that broke my heart again, and I decided to run for our Citizenship and Legislative Committee. And it's been a real honor to serve the local. I think we have a lot of work to do. We're entering the most important 11 months of our political lives, leading up to the 2006 elections. We've got some congressmen that we need to vote out of office and get some state reps in office that are more labor friendly. We've got a lot of work to do, and I'm honored to be in that, serving in that capacity.
Doug Rademacher. Lyle, as you just said, we're in a fight. Lansing's been called the capital of quality, and they've built 19 million vehicles, I guess, out of this particular facility. And General Motors has reinvested in Lansing, Michigan, no place else in North America since the Saturn plant of the, I believe, the 80s. So can you talk about that? Why is Lansing the capital of quality? What makes it happen?
I think it's the people. One of the things that they mentioned when this new Delta plant was coming on, that they were actually going to bring anthropologists in to study the culture of Lansing and what makes it so unique to the rest of the North American workforce. I mean, think about it. We were the only plant left that was trucking bodies from one building to another, yet Harbor and Associates ranked our two assembly lines 1 and 2 for efficiency. That speaks to the people. I used to be fond of expressing that when we did plant tours. I would talk about what a great organization we have, from the men and women on the production to our friends on skilled trades, and even the managing. Everybody working together has made Lansing what it is today, and it's a longstanding tradition that we're going to continue out of Delta.
Could you share one more thing? What about the skilled trades? What's the relationship that you've experienced with trades and the production line?
Well, it was a real pleasure and a privilege working with a lot of those folks. Working in weld integrity, what our job would do is we would monitor weld quality. If we found something going on that needed to be addressed, we would contact the area electrician. So I got to know them all. And you learned who had the skills for we all have our gifts, and some folks are better than others at different things, and I really came to respect of a lot of the electricians. A real pleasure working with them. Yes, sir.
Mike
Fleming. Well, being a local union official and have really gotten into giving back to your membership, what would you consider your most appreciated bargain benefit by the UAW?
Wow, seniority, it's huge. The wages we make, it's wonderful. Without the UAW, I would not been able to be the productive member of our the community of which I live. I wouldn't have been able to buy a home. I wouldn't have been able to support my school district. I wouldn't have been able to do a lot of things for my kids. And thank goodness for the benefits the UAW negotiated for me and everybody else. Lansing is a good town because of it. You know, I like to share this with folks. I don't bank offshore. I don't have an offshore bank account. All my money stays right here in this community. It goes right back into the community, and the community is better for that. So I'm very grateful for everything that's been negotiated on my behalf. My kids take advantage of the tuition assistance for a dependents. I have two kids in college, and to go political right now, I'm flabbergasted that guys like Congressman Mike Rogers voted to cut $14 billion out of the student loan program. But thank goodness that the UAW still has has that benefit for the students.
You know, we just negotiated some changes within our national contract, which allowed some our retirees to keep their health care, which they pay a portion of, and active employees to pay to defer a portion of their raises going forward. How do you feel about that, Lyle?
It's all about sticking together and taking care of those who could use some help. You know, there's a courageous group of individuals down in Grass Lake, Michigan, that the company they worked for, Tenneco, was going to unilaterally take the meager benefits that their pensioners were going to get and just say, well, this is all for health care. You're not getting anything. And it was illegal. It was immoral. And after a year of litigation, the company finally backed off, but only because of the efforts of the UAW Local 660. Since then, retribution has been relentless, perhaps due to the fact of bruised egos on the part of some key managers. I don't know why, but they've been forced out on an unfair labor practice strike for 8 months, and all for the same reason. They were standing up for their pensioners, their retirees, and some of these senior citizens are World War II, Korean, and Vietnam vets, or their widows. So, yeah, it's an honor to be able to help our sisters and brothers of the UAW who really needed assistance in that regard.
Now it sounds to me as though you really get it. Can you agree or disagree that you feel within the United States right now labor is under attack?
Oh, certainly. All out. It's all out war. Warren Buffett, the billionaire of the, Hathaway Mutual Fund, he says the war between the rich and the poor, right now the rich are winning it hands down. And, I'm reminded of what our friend Mike Huerta said the other day. He was relating how every benefit out there was because of organized labor stepping up, whether it was a 40-hour work week, whether it was safer working conditions. Basic dignity, the UAW and other labor organizations have led the way. So we have a lot of work to do.
Lyle, once again, coming back to Maryland Culture, coming back to the UAW and Fisher Body, thank you for what you do. Currently, you're doing something that's special, that's actually been something unprecedented that the UAW and GM have been doing as we close the doors of our old plant and open the new. You want to speak a little bit about that and the impact of GM UAW on the community?
Sure. About a year ago, our chairman, Steve Bramus, called me on the phone, asked me if I wanted to coordinate. We have what's called a jobs bank. It's a negotiated benefit, been around for years through the UAW. And one of the things that we wanted to do was to coordinate a Jobs Bank Community Service Program where members of UAW Local 602 could go out in the community and help nonprofit organizations with many worthy causes. It's probably been one of the most rewarding experiences in my life, in that we've been able to establish a relationship with over 250 agencies, not only in the immediate Lansing area, but the greater Lansing area, extending out in other counties beyond the Tri-County area. Folks like the Charlton Park Historical Village, we've been able to provide them with a number of volunteers who have been doing everything from archaeological digs to reconstructing Potawatomi Indian villages to painting buildings, replacing roofs. Bill Ford, one of my favorite pictures from that is he's dressed up in Union blues, portraying a Union soldier. And what he has been doing is he portrays a teacher in a one-room schoolhouse with a wood stove in the, right at smack dab in the middle. It's just like the old days. And they bus kids in from all over. It's a field trip thing. And they see all the different buildings. And Bill will actually portray a teacher, and these kids sit through a session of one-room schoolhouse experience. And this guy loves it so much that he intends to continue volunteering there whenever he can as he returns to Delta. It's stuff like that. The other folks are, some are dressing up as a husband and wife inn, and they actually greet the kids and they'll feed them soup. Brenda, she'll cook up the soup, and they feed these kids soup made on a wood stove. A wood cook stove, and the amount of good they've done just in that one area. But there's so much more. A lot of great proactive programs, such as the Capital Area Literacy Coalition. Gilbert Cuellar, for example, this guy has gone to immigrant labor camps, helped teach kids how to read, helped teach illiterate folks how to read in the Lansing area, folks that are from around here. It's a very great program. Head Start, Julie Kepler, we've been working with her, providing Head Start volunteers in the classrooms. This is all about proactive, helping children make right decisions at an early age. America will be better for it. And I could go on and on and on the organizations that we've been able to help. Currently, as probably at this point, we could safely say we've placed over 750 UAW Local 602 members in different positions off and on throughout the past year. Currently, we're at around 450 that are out there in the field.
So, Lyle, Doug Rademacher, on that, you're saying that this bargain benefit with the Fisher plant closing May 5th of 05, these people had the choice to sit and be paid their wages, but they choose to volunteer in their community.
Yeah, and many others are going to school. Just a sidebar to all this, when the plant closed on May 5th, it was probably the leading up to that and then immediately following was probably the craziest time in my entire career at General Motors. I went for 4 or 5 weeks without even a lunch break. And it wasn't just me. We had a great team of folks. I want to thank Doug for helping out and a lot of others. There was a lot of people that came into the picture and left. As Delta fires up, people come and then they go back to work. And there's a lot of people that were very instrumental in implementing the program. It wasn't just me. It was a lot of people working together. And Mike, too. Thanks, man. Sorry.
Is there anything that you'd like to talk, Marilyn Coulter, is there anything that you'd like to talk about that we haven't touched on?
Can I go on a little bit of tours?
Sure. Now, talk about the tours. You were the plant tour guy, guide, right?
Yeah.
First shift, was that?
Well, I did the tours on the night shift, too.
Yes, Lyle, please go ahead and tell us about the plant tours.
Back in 91, the word went out that they were going to interview for a non-traditional job called plant tours, and I was really honored to be able to be part of that program. Dave Pardee and I, he came on several months later and worked with John Rosendahl and a number of others. And it was really an amazing experience to set the program up right from the beginning and learn by the seat of your pants. Nobody showed me how to do a whole lot of anything other than John has a wealth of experience. John Rosendahl, my former boss there, has a wealth of experience in public speaking and PR, so I learned a great deal from him, and for that I'm grateful. We were a funny story. Can I share a funny story about culture? One of the first tours we had was Auto Vaz. It was the Russian auto industry at the time. Remember, this is back in 91. And things have changed a great deal since then. But it was like the Lee Iacocca equivalent of the Russian auto industry visiting. There was four dignitaries, and they had their translator. And we're walking them around and showing them the plant. And obviously, they didn't have anything like what we had. This was probably one of the most technologically advanced body shops in the industry at the time. And we're all talking through interpreters, and obviously the conversation was pretty slow, but he had made a joke and we all laughed and I gave him a big thumbs up. And right when I did it, I was horrified. I thought, oh my gosh, I don't know if I just gave this guy the finger in Russian culture or not. And fortunately, they all laughed and everything was smooth over, but I'll never forget that little moment there. And we had folks from, the head of Pontiac and all the different head honchos that were we built the cars for. They'd come through. I'll never forget when John Middlebrook was coming in. They had an advanced person come, and this was a big, important tour. And John Rosendahl paged me. I had a pager at the time, and I didn't have a phone right nearby, so I ducked in and asked the oilers. We have a team that oils all the different equipment, if I could borrow their phone. And they're great guys. I'd talked to them for years. And I went in there and I called John. He says, yeah, she's down at the other end, the advanced person. You need to meet her. I said, great. Well, I hung up the phone, and the guy said, hey, Lyle, before you leave, can you play a song for us on a harmonica? So I said, yeah, sure. So I grabbed the harp out and wail on it and give him a quick tune, and we're all cutting up and laughing, and I'm prepared to go. And one of the guys accidentally bumped one of his oil guns, and I kid you not, I got a blast of grease right on my crotch. Right before, I kid you not, these are dress pants. I got this big old spot, and I'm going, oh, my gosh, what am I going to do? I have to meet this woman in just a matter of minutes. And, you know, I show up and got this, and I explained her the whole situation. In the meantime, I had phoned my wife, bless her heart. She was able to bring me another pair of pants. So by the time the tour came off, I was sporting a different pair of pants, and nobody was none the wiser. However, she made sure everybody knew, and you know, that's one of the things when you work a group, something happens. A temporary sense of community takes shape, and you get to know, even though these are people that probably, truth be known, you're nothing more than nothing to them, because they have such a slanted point of view of working people. But at the time, we would, especially that particular group of people, we were all joking, and she brought that up right in front of everybody, and we all shared a laugh. But the guys in the oiler room, we joked about that one for years. And a sidebar to all that, the guy felt so bad about it; it was not intentional, and he offered to use some of that hot thinner to, and I said, no, not there. Yes, sir.
Mike Fleming, Lau. You were talking about your tours. Can you talk about how you got from one area to the next? Because our plant is layered, and you got a body shop on the very bottom floor, and you got paint on the very top floor. Did you do that? Or what did you do?
That's an excellent question. Our tours were primarily on the main floor. Even when we did walking tours, and when we did... Let me take that back. When we did walking tours, I would always try to get upstairs a little bit and show them a little bit of the M system, because I felt the need to show. But for so many years, we had this refurbished train from the 50s. This thing is vintage. And I hope that we'll be able to have that at the Delta plant. This thing is cool looking. It's old, it's vintage, and it's been outfitted with a PA. One person drives and one sits in the back and does the talking through a microphone. And the nice thing about that, in that particular facility, realize that that plant was built in 1920. It's an original Durant plant. And the support posts are fairly close together, and the ceilings were low, but it was those posts that posed such a problem, because we're building, heck, we're the leading producer of automobiles year in, year out, year in, year out. We'd build more cars than anyone else. That meant that our friends on material handling had to be delivering this stuff. So here we are with this group of people. Last thing you wanted to do is do it on foot with fork trucks coming this way and that way, flatbeds. It was a safety issue, so we were very grateful that we had the train, and we would take the folks on the train. But I always loved doing the foot tours, because you could take them up close to the equipment, you know, get them right by the fence, and they could see how some of the intricacies of the manufacturing process, especially out in the body shop. And I'd always point out to them that, you know, high tech is only as good as the men and women behind it. And that our UAW Local 602 electricians did an outstanding job at keeping this equipment running. And when the people left, I was convinced they came away with a better point of view of the brothers and sisters of UAW Local 602. Can I keep going a little bit on some of these stories? Because I really got a kick out of some of this tour stuff.
Yeah, I want you to. Sure. This is Doug Rademacher. I wanted you to continue on. Would you share the diversity of the groups that came through?
Oh, we had people from all over the planet. And we'd get a lot of tourists in the summertime.
Go.
We would have folks come in from all over the planet. And I always realized the people from other countries, they weren't going to buy our vehicles. But it was important that they heard our story. But I also took it very seriously when we could sell the idea of our product, because nothing happens until the product is sold. I'm a salesman at heart, and I firmly believe that sales and marketing is critical to any venture. And I always took it very seriously that I always told all the best I possibly could about what we were doing. And I took it very seriously. We had people come in from all over. A funny story about the Netherlands, okay? You know, here in Michigan, everybody holds up that hand, and you can say, well, I'm from here or there. You know, it's a Michigan thing. You talk to somebody from Montana or somebody from Texas, and they look at you like, well, why are you holding your hand up? Yeah, sad to say, many of our fellow countrymen don't even realize that Michigan, at least the lower peninsula part, is a hand. And I got this phone call, and this woman's calling from the Netherlands. It was the Royal Engineering Society. They're talking about 25 to 30 people that were going to be coming in and touring America. And they were going to travel from Chicago to Detroit. And they were going to, while they were in Detroit, they were going to tour an auto plant. Well, one of the things I take great pride in, the fact that as I was in that position as scheduler for the tours, is I would try to promote Lansing. I'd love it if somebody would buy a car, but I'd also appreciate it if I was able to talk them into renting a motel room, spending the night. That meant they were going to take in a meal, maybe a movie, go out and spend their dollars in Lansing. And that's what being a neighbor is all about. We had people coming in to see our facility, and I always wanted to share Lansing. I developed a relationship with the Lugnuts, the local minor league sports team, and I'd have that schedule right there. And if I could tell them, hey, there's a ball game that night, you really should go. Ever been to a minor league ball game? But back to the Netherlands. So that promoter in me kicked in, and I got her to hold up her hand and explain to her that between Chicago and Detroit is Lansing, and that we could probably put her in touch with our friends at the Lansing Convention and Visitors Bureau, with whom I had a relationship. I like to work with them and get as much promotional ideas from them as possible. And I got her holding up her hand, talking to me from the other side of the planet, for crying out loud. And I talked her into coming to our tour. And I put her in touch with folks at the Lansing Convention and Visitors Bureau, and they stayed not one night, but two nights. And that was like 15 motel rooms. So they stayed two nights. They loved our plant tour, but they also took in other things in Lansing. And I always thought that was a home run for the people of Lansing. Always liked to promote Lansing. Folks came here for their vacations. We had this one fella. He was a real likable guy. I just took to him right away. He just slap you on the back, friendly sort of guy. Turned out he owned a string of funeral parlors out in Montana. Well, at the time, Dave Pardee, my partner, and I, we had secured a stack of Pontiac Grand Am posters. And we had handed out a few to our friends, and but we were supposed to be just handing them out for tours, and that's what we did. Well, I'm realizing that this guy, and I also realized that many of the people who were impressed with our tours, this is something that I felt strongly about. They would talk about what a great organization Lansing Car Assembly it was, and oh, by the way, what do you think of those Grand Ams? Aren't they great? It would sell cars long after they were gone. You're drinking coffee with your buddy, and the subject of cars come up, and they'll tell how they went to Lansing and toured that automobile assembly plant, and the men and women that worked there were so friendly. What a great bunch of people, and that's a great car they built. You can't put a dollar amount on that kind of PR. So, knowing this, we've got this fella from Montana, and he's just loving it. And he has obviously a wide range of influence in his communities where he has these funeral homes. I sent him home with, I think, a dozen of those posters. And the reason why is I knew he would tell our story each time he gave out one of those posters. And then he probably told the story even more because we treated him so well. And it was a mutual thing. I mean, we just hit it off so well. But he's probably still telling our stories. We got a card from him, and he bought his daughter a Grand Am. And that was really cool. One of the other things that Bill Ross, a superintendent up in Paint, he has a motor coach. And our vehicles were towable. And a lot of these motor coach people would tow these vehicles, and we would go out and do a show out in Charlotte with Spartan Motors. And we would do tell them about how our vehicles are towable.
Excuse me, sir. I'm looking for a printer.
After we did a couple of those trade shows with Spartan Motors that builds the chassis for these motor coaches, I was now very well informed on the fact that our vehicles are towable. So I started using that as a selling point. And right towards the end there, as the tour program wound down, I was on the phone with a fella from Iowa. And they had a motor coach, and they'd heard about our tours. And I found out that one of the other things I would do is help steer people towards lodging. And they wanted to find a place to camp, so that gave me the hint, oh, what are you running? And once I found out he had a motor coach, I told him, oh, by the way, did you know that the Malibu and the Grand Am and the Alero are towable? It made my day when we picked him up with the tour train. He held up a set of Malibu keys. That was sweet, knowing that I helped sell that car. And we like to think, those of us that were with the tour program, we like to think we sold a lot of cars over the years, because that's what it's all about, telling the story, changing people's perception of auto workers, and if we can, like them to buy our product as well.
Lyle, you have done many things over the years, but can you tell me how has your relationship with Fisher Body Plant carried over into your own community? Do you do anything for schools? Do you do anything for...
Oh, yeah. I was pretty busy. I'll never forget, my daughter was in fifth grade, and that's typically when they start playing a musical instrument in school band. And our next door neighbor dragged me to a band booster meeting. You know, I'm going, okay, I'll go. And I'd been a volunteer at the Eagle Park for a number of years prior to that. My wife and I both worked at the Eagle Fair. It's a little town outside of Lansing, and the whole facility there, everything from the banquet facilities to the grandstand to all the buildings, the Eagle Park, those of us in 602 are very familiar with that because we have our annual picnic there. But my wife and I built a house just north of Eagle back beginning in 81, and we got to know all of the friends and neighbors, so we started volunteering at the park. And, you know, that park is built without a dime of government money. So we did a lot of work with that. But back to the band booster thing, we went to the meeting and the whole board resigned. And the next meeting I went to, I ended up being elected band booster president. So that was kind of crazy. And at the time, they had just gone through two band directors. The high school marching band was down to, I think, 18 or 20 kids. The uniforms were old and worn. So it was an interesting challenge in that I'd never ran meetings or dealt with irate parents. And everybody had their own agendas. There was one guy. He was bound and determined that they're going to still go on that. Every 4 years, they'd go on a Florida trip, as if that was a reason why you'd take band. I always thought it was to learn how to play an instrument, have fun playing music, you know. But, you know, dealing with that type of thing, it was a real challenge. But we did get the uniforms, smoothed over the whole Florida trip thing, because I knew in my heart we needed to get these kids decent uniforms that they could wear and be proud of, and that would help build the numbers and rebuild the band. And fortunately, a few other people stepped up, and the two in particular stepped up in a big way, and we were able to turn the program around. And I feel real good about that. I backed away from that over the years and took up coaching soccer. My wife, bless her heart, she kind of inspired me to do that. She's a natural coach. We'll watch a basketball game or a football game, and she points all these things out, and I'm going, oh, yeah. I think when our youngest one graduates, she'll probably get back into coaching like teenage soccer. She coached like 3 years of undefeated soccer for our middle daughter. They just had a great team, but they also had a great coach. So my wife and I, we did a lot of coaching. And then more recently, I volunteered with the Athletic Boosters out there in Portland and did a lot of good with that program. And I've since backed away from that. Probably the longest-running volunteer program I've ever done is the Bluegrass Revival Band that started 19 years ago as a result of that UAWGM talent contest. And that is a nonprofit thing. All we ever get is a little gas money and maybe a bite to eat occasionally. And it all goes back into the group to buy equipment and to just maintain expenses, to keep the microphones up, all that. And that's probably been one of the most wonderful experiences arising, other than being married to Brenda, arising out of my relationship with General Motors and the UAW, is the fact that this group of Union Brothers put this band together, and we're still doing it. And, you know, Don, that early on, he said, "Lyle, you're going to meet some of the nicest people in the world," and he was right. We've met terrific people all across the state of Michigan. And it's been a wonderful time. Prior to that, I played a lot of bars, and, you know, you have people that have a bit too much to drink and get stupid and secondhand smoke. Playing these church gigs, you don't have secondhand smoke or obnoxious drunks, and a lot of times they feed you afterwards. So that's great, you know, and that's been a wonderful experience. We're working on our sixth album. We're going to record another one over the winter.
Is there any other story, Lyle, that you have wanted to share that we haven't got on yet?
What a great experience doing the tours was. And I felt a deep responsibility to everybody in the organization to make sure that every time, it's like show business. If you go on stage, it you do not mention anything if you we messed up on that song. Remember that on the second chorus, how we got off key? You don't do that. It's showtime. And I always took it very seriously when you went out there in front of the people and you gave the very best every time. If you were sick, if you didn't feel bad, you're having a bad day, it didn't matter. When you had this group of people that came to your plant, it was such an honor and a pleasure and a privilege to represent everybody. Not just the sisters and brothers of UAW 602, but also the management counterparts, everybody, and the city of Lansing. And I feel real good about that one because I think we did a lot of good on that. One of the other programs that came about out of that tour program, I had a call from a school, Union City. It was a little too far to drive. They didn't have a lot of money for buses. So the idea went off in my head, well, why don't I bring the tour to you? So we had a little video that we would always play for everybody, a little preview. And I took that video down there, and we set up in the library, and they heard it in two classes at a time. And talk about being on the spot. Again, just flying by the seat of my pants, never had any training on this thing, but it was a hoot. I just loved working with the kids. And John Rosendahl, bless his heart, he gave me free rein to develop that program. I called it the Classroom Visit Program. And I sincerely hope that we can implement something along those lines in the future because it evolved. Initially, that first day and the following days, and I started doing them more often, I realized I could talk to 250 people by noon. Whereas with the tour train, the best we could do is maybe 60, 70 people on a given day. But by doing two groups at a time, and I would go to them, so it would save them money. They didn't have to hire a bus driver, and a lot of these school districts are so strapped. But one of the things that evolved from that whole classroom visit program is I started to turn it into a motivational seminar to study. And to this day, I still get calls from teachers that ask me to come. There's a career class out west of here, small town, and that guy still calls me to come and address his class because what I do is I talk about the UAW, I talk about GM, talk about what's going on in Lansing, but I also talk about how it applies to each one of those kids. I'll get that board going and we'll start at one end and I'll get that interaction going and we'll talk about career choices. And, you know, I remember the last one I did, this girl held up her hand and I asked her what she wanted to do. She says, well, I want to be a hairdresser. And I feel good about this one because I happened to talk to her dad a couple weeks later, and he just got the biggest kick out of it. I asked her, I said, well, how many chairs do you want in your shop, and how many shops do you want to have? And what I was able to do is put it in her mind that she didn't just have to be a hairdresser, did she? She could own her own shop or a whole string of them. And that's what it's all about, is encouraging these kids and give them, widen their horizons. And a lot of times, if it was a middle school class, I point out the fact that, hey, you have 4 years of free school. Don't spend $12,000 as a freshman taking remedial math, for instance. Take those math classes now. Make it count. And I always felt really, really good about that, and that was a very rewarding experience. And I'm grateful to John that he allowed me to go do that. I'm grateful that the UAW had that program to begin with. And you know, it's just funny how things will get going, and you can run with it. A number of years ago, they pulled the plug on the program, and that was a sad day to see that come. An equally sad day was the last day when we had our open house. The plant was about to close. People came in from all over, retirees, folks I hadn't seen in years, and we did the train. And it tugged at your heart. You know, we did an abbreviated tour. What it was is every year we would do this Bring Your Child to Work Day, and that last couple years they'd at least get me off the line to do Bring Your Child to Work Day. But that last Bring Your Child Work Day was literally an open house for the plant. It was all the end of it, and it was touching, you know, knowing that it was the last day that you were out there. And we ran the train every 20 minutes. We'd have another group of people, and I'd play the harmonica, and Joe Jodway and I, I'd make sure everybody gave Joe a big hand because he did a great job driving. And we had a ball that day. We did it that day and that night. But that was the last day we ran the train, and the plant closed shortly thereafter.
Lyle Marilyn Coulter, question. Did you bring your harp today?
Yeah.
Will you allow them to hear what we've heard for so many years, for a brief period?
Yeah, and I'm going to tell you a story, all right?
Okay.
Can you stop that just a second while I get it off? One of the things that, as tour guide coordinator, again, you know, we had a relationship with the Visitors Bureau and a lot of the folks in Lansing. We had the automotive history corridor program through the National Park Service. And attending these meetings, they were talking about recording interviews with senior citizens in a given area. And a year ago, Kevin Beard and I were coordinating all these activities for the Jobs Bank program. I remembered that, you know, back when we were doing the National Automotive History Corridor program through the Park Service, they used to meet at the Historical Museum. They had this program where they would interview senior citizens and retirees to capture history. Kevin and I talked about it, and Kevin, probably one of the smartest guys I know, he knew people at Michigan State University. Somewhere along the line, Doug Rademacher was contacted and other people, and this whole history project has taken shape. I feel pretty good about this one. But, Marilyn, to answer your question about the playing the harmonica, mm-hmm. back in I was on the night shift on the C system in doing water test, and we used to have this thing called the wagon break. And we were literally the last plant that enjoyed this benefit.
Tell us what that was.
And the plant would shut down for 6 minutes at a given time in the morning and a 6 minute period in the afternoon. And the folks from the cafeteria pushed these little carts out, and there'd be a coffee urn there, and there'd be a hot water urn, and they'd have all sorts of cookies and all sorts of junk food and chips. And, you know, we could go and buy this stuff and have a cup of coffee. And this was something that had always been there. Well, not always, but it was a negotiated benefit. And I really loved the wagon break. We all did. You could turn that six-minute break into a little longer because you could work up the line a little bit. Well, in negotiations, that was one of the things that went away. And it's kind of touching, really. They used to have a PA where you could just walk up to a phone and get on the PA. And off and on over the years, I'd play a tune or two, you know, play a Christmas song at the holidays or play something fired up right before changeover, get people riled up out there and see trim. I worked out there in a water test booth at the time. And the wagon break, it was the last wagon break in General Motors. And this is what I did. I got on the PA and I said, hey, this is for the last wagon break in General Motors. It was on the night shift. It was a Friday night. It literally was the last wagon break for General Motors. And in honor of that, I did this. I played the whole song, but for this, I'll just do that. But yeah, and that was kind of a moving night, you know, the end of an era. And we've seen a lot of ends of the era, you know. But an incredible future with this Delta plant kicking in. Hopefully they'll let me play something on the PA over there to kick it all off. I don't know.
Well, Lyle, it's just been a wonderful opportunity to have your story today. We appreciate you taking the time to come in and share it with those people that will hear this and have no clue about what the auto industry was all about and what goes on inside the four walls of an assembly plant. I want to thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.